Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. Today I'm talking to Dr. Valerie Hazanov, author of The Fear of Doing Nothing, Notes of a Young Therapist. And my name is Sebastian Truhl, I'm your host for today. Valerie's book was published by Sphinx in 2019, and he is a Russian-Israeli clinical psychologist with a PhD from Columbia University. He is a former fellow of the American Psychoanalytic Association and the Columbia Psychoanalytic Center. He's also winner of the 2013 Psychotherapy Case Presentation Award by the William Allenson White Institute for a paper that's actually of the same title as the book we will talk about today. Today, Valerie lives in Israel, is in private practice in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and he's the clinical director of Headspace Israel, a psychology treatment center for youth. Valerie, welcome to the program.
Welcome, and it's wonderful to be here, and shalom from Jerusalem.
Great. So nice to have you. Let me just, for our listening audience, give a short overview over the book. It's a memoir, pretty much. It's autobiographical about your training, graduate school in New York City. And it takes us on a journey through 10 chapters. 10 cases, or like 10 instances of you working with patients, or rather with people, because it's very intimate. It's not your typical case presentation that's very heavy on jargon, right? It's very it's almost in a way literary.
Well, I hope so. To add to what you said, the book's premise is the first chapter is me sitting at the therapist's office, complaining about the fact that I don't know what I'm doing, and maybe it sounds playful and ironic, but it was the opposite. It was not playful and it was not ironic. It was a huge dread of mine that I got into a profession that really doesn't do much, right? And kind of, in a sense, I was looking for something special for several years in my undergrad in Jerusalem and during graduate school, in the beginning of graduate school, just something, a special ingredient, I would say, to psychotherapy that would convince me that what I'm doing is actually worthwhile and helping others and not just plainly. I wouldn't say maybe a waste of time, that's too glib, but just a conversation with people for what it's worth. Sometimes it's an okay conversation, sometimes it felt a little bit meaningless and so on. And so the first chapter is me sitting as a therapist and trying to kind of get from him, him as a symbolic him, right? As the representative of psychotherapy, of established psychotherapists or analysts. So what is it then? I read some of the papers or many papers. I read books. I had classes. But I'm not convinced. And again, this is not a trick that I'm trying to do, right? Like to sound provocative or anything like that. Maybe, I don't know. I hope it doesn't come across that way because there was nothing provocative about it. It was just an honest hesitation and an honest search for something that is psychotherapy. And then that came to me around, let's say, the second year of graduate school, when I thought of writing this book with these experiences. And what I'm describing is, in the next 9 chapters, is work with real people that I met mostly in my internship in New York, but also in other clinics and kind of mostly community clinics and hospitals in New York. You have one-on-one cases, couples case.
Yeah.
A group, and just a day at a clinic, one after the other, which maybe emphasizes certainly the diversity of New York and of psychotherapy, but also many moments in which it does feel a little bit flat. And what is there really that I'm doing? So that was the attempt. It's not necessarily chronological, from chapter 2 to chapter 10, let's say, but it is, I hope, takes the reader to a certain to a certain journey that we take together, from maybe the peak of my kind of hesitation and struggle to hopefully maybe a more kind of settled place. Which would be nice, you know, if it happened in other areas of my life.
Yeah.
Kind of. And I actually always keep it in mind, right? I mean, life did not end for me, thankfully, at the end of the graduate school. And so when I think of other areas in my life when I'm not sure about what to do, how to be, I always keep in mind that a certain kind of vision that I had about clinical psychology that, of course, turned out to be something completely different than I thought, but still kind of was murking somewhere there. And to that vision, I try to walk. And I hope that the book maybe is successful in describing that that process that I went through, that essentially I feel it's a bit amorphous, but the idea is that I hope there is some progress between a complete confusion, or almost a complete confusion, to a place that it's a bit more settled, but still not maybe too organized. You know, when someone asks me, what is psychotherapy? Jung has, by the way, a beautiful answer to that. What is psychotherapy? And he says, Jung, yes. He says, well, depends on the patient, depends when, depends with whom, depends how. And I think I read it only after I wrote the book, actually, that quote, particular quote by Jung. But that was my feeling. And I tried to describe it as honestly as I could with every person that I met, with every struggle that I had, and frequently trying to be honest when things didn't work out great, and I didn't feel that it was an amazing achievement.
Right.
You know, that's one of my kind of biggest problems with case studies, or this genre of popular case studies that is, by the way, not very popular. There's not too many books like that, but there are, you know, I think we all know a few authors.
Yeah.
What I always struggle with is these amazing transformations, right? I mean, whatever you do, whether you do CBT, whether you do psychoanalysis, however you want to call it, ACT, IPT, whatever, and there's always this promise of an enormous transformation. And I think psychoanalysis was known for it in the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. We all know that it was devised as this kind of short-term treatment, as funny as it sounds now, because the transformations were amazing, right? Someone couldn't raise her right hand, let's say Anna O, and then she could. Why? Because the treatment, because the cure.
Right.
And I think that didn't disappear from the world of psychotherapy. Every new therapy that arrives offers that. And, you know, people who write it are very smart and have many times and have wonderful the great reasoning for why it should be that way. And
in the
meanwhile, I felt frequently a bit like an idiot, like it doesn't work that way for me. And I feel that perhaps many other trainees are in a similar position. I felt that way. People who trained with me were kind of hesitant, confused, not sure. And then something interesting happens, right? As we go along in the profession, so we gather like some tools to fight that fear of doing nothing, whether it's truly jargon, so you're not even sure what the paper is talking about, what the person is talking about, but it all sounds like very sophisticated. And then, you know, you leave, let's say, a talk, and then people are kind of glancing at each other. Like, I didn't understand anything, but what probably just very say? Smart.
Yeah, right.
Or a very neat kind of CBT or research presentation in which you clearly understand that this intervention will lead to, like, I don't know, 20% betterment over time for someone who struggles with this particular problem.
Right, right.
For me, it never felt that way. Psychotherapy never just felt that way. I tried. Like, it would be wonderful if it would have been that way.
Right.
It never was like that. It was always very messy and very chaotic, I think, and perhaps like life itself. And it just felt like life, right? Like small changes here and there, maybe. You're not even sure, but... That's what I'm trying to describe, and maybe later on I'll read a small something just to give more of a taste more of a specific taste to what I'm talking about. But so that's kind of a very long answer. But
I think it's very interesting how you describe the discrepancy between what you were first expecting psychotherapy, psychoanalysis to be, and then what it felt like actually being with people, being with patients. And I think what the book captures so beautifully is your own development, right? And your through your struggle. And you have this beautiful quote that I'd like to read out to give listeners a sense of points in your journey where you're actually figuring stuff out. And there's this quote where you say, "I just really dislike the pretense of our textbooks and case studies that it is somehow a question of a particular intervention or a particularly deep realization or a particularly smart combination of medications, because it's not. It's a grind. That's what it is."
Yeah, that's how it felt. And you know, this discrepancy, I left it out of the book a little bit, but kind of a little bit about my own maybe story here, which doesn't really appear in the book that much. I hint to it, but not really. I'm coming from generations of Russian doctors and scientists, in a sense, right?
Right.
My parents, my grandparents, my ancestors, essentially. And I think it really affected my worldview and affected kind of my sensibility about psychotherapy, because above all, for me...
So you mean an idea of being a scientist, or like what would you say is like the core of that belief?
Just someone comes to you with a problem and you want to help him.
Right.
I mean, in a very basic kind of way. And I think it's very clear as a doctor, this is what you're doing. I think it's very clear as a scientist that this is what you're trying to do. You're trying to solve a certain problem, to reach a certain truth. And therapy, you know, it's
not kind so of, clear, right? Not so clear.
And I think for us, it's almost a cliche, right? That therapy is between science and art, and it all sounds beautiful. But it doesn't sound that beautiful when you're sitting in a class, you know, let's say I remember in undergrad, and kind of really in kind of this deep hesitation, did I choose right? Like, did I do the right thing? And what am I going to do? And then someone presents to you, like, let's say, a 2x2 table of attachment, right?
Right.
And like, that's one way of looking at it, and which really distanced me from the field and frightened me. Or the opposite scale, when there's like this paper that's a psycholytic paper with so many terms, and you're not even quite sure like how it is connected to life, to people you know, to your own life,
right?
To your patients. It's in my experience, it's not connected many times, and that really was difficult for me because in a very kind of egotistical, maybe narcissistic way, just kind of like, what am I doing? Like, why did I choose to do it? I could have done other things, potentially being a medical doctor, obviously.
Right.
That
right.
would be the easiest choice in some way, but maybe other things that the result would be so much clearer than this kind of murky. And then, you know, kind of in our community, when people say, no, Valerie, this is like, you're doing a great job or something like that, or like, no, you're providing a safe space or things of that nature. Like, it never felt enough. Like, it felt like, no, I mean, it's not enough. I want more. I want to help the person in front of me because I see that he is in enormous pain and I can't reach him. I just can't. And the pain doesn't go away. And we're meeting once, and we're meeting for a month, and we're meeting for 7 months, and the pain is still there. Maybe this, like, almost the same as it was 7 months ago, or whenever. And that is not a pleasant feeling, right? I mean, that is not a pleasant feeling for someone who kind of went into the field with this hope, with the hope of giving something to another human being.
Right, but in a way, let me ask you this, right? You reading the book, like I was saying, it feels very personal, right? Mm-hmm. Even your style of writing. You're writing a lot about your own situation, your feelings while sitting with patients, while being in conflict with patients. Mm-hmm. And like a question that just came to my mind was, why go all in like that? Right, I mean, because you can write psychoanalytic, psychotherapeutic literature books that have much more distance to your own experience, to patients. Mm. Why go all in like that? Mm. I mean, the honesty is amazing, right? But
thank you.
coming from that ambivalence that you're describing, why take that leap?
Mm. Well, first of all, I suck at psychoanalytic writing, right? I think if I would write a psychoanalytic paper, it would be very mediocre.
But that's absolutely not the case.
No, for real.
This paper that was awarded by the
no, go on, the award. No, Sebastian, you're too nice to me. I'm telling you, like, I think if I would have written like just a plain psychoanalytic paper with a theory of mind, like a new theory of mind, I think I would suck, basically.
But then I guess we have to define psychoanalytic paper, right? Because there's many papers that are very clinical, very technical, but at the same time you get a sense of the author, right? You kind of get a feeling of what they're going through. You get to experience them in a way.
Mm.
And that's probably the best psychoanalytic literature, right?
Yes, absolutely.
But it seems like you're doing something different here, and that's like, on the back of the book, it's actually likened to Bulgakov's book about him being a young doctor, right?
Yes, a very flattering comparison by my publisher.
Well, it's great, and I totally get that.
Yes.
But why go all in like that?
Mm. So I think, first of all, despite your compliments, I think that I cannot do what Stephen Mitchell, Freud, Jung, Klein, and the people I love in psychoanalysis did. I really don't. And I think it's important to understand also, kind of with intellectual honesty, what you can and cannot do. Similarly to me understanding that I cannot write a novel like Tolstoy, right? I mean, it's just like I can try.
Right.
Right. I can try to write an epos, but probably it won't work. I think part of it is my personality. Just it's as funny as it is. Perhaps it's my comfort zone. Even let me tell you, it's not always great, right? I mean, it's not always great to be so revealing and honest.
That's, yeah, I could see that. Yeah.
Yes. Can you foresee some potential problems there? Right.
Possibly.
I mean, one or two, possibly. To go all in most of what you do in your personal life, in your professional life, it doesn't always work out great. But
yeah.
I think a hope that I have is that I'm capturing something that is not only mine, right? That it will resonate. People ask me, who are you writing this book to? Many times. And I said, I'm not quite sure whether the book will go from being a book for therapists to a book to just people who love, I don't know, reading.
Right.
I'm not quite sure. I'm still not sure.
And that's actually very interesting that you're saying that, because when I was reading the book for this interview, I was lying around in my apartment and my parents came by. They're not from the psychotherapy profession at all. And they just flipped through it and were like, wow, this is actually really interesting, right? Like this is relatable. I think I might get the book, right? So that's kind of the feel it gets, right?
Well,
like,
first of all, say thank you to your parents for me for taking the time to read the book. But I got that kind of anecdotal feedback from mostly from people that I know that said that it really resonated with them, but. For me, my main aim at the book was to speak about an experience that I hope is not only mine, meaning that I think that perhaps this state of confusion, not only confusion, but also this dissonance, right, that I'm describing between how therapy is talked about, written about, presented, versus how it actually feels doing it. Hope that I'm capturing here something that is an experience that is quite common among trainees, at least, and maybe therapists in general. Some therapists. It's a position of a bit of an outsider to the field.
You mean being a beginner or like being in training? Being an outsider, or
I feel broader than that. I feel that it's not only being a trainee. It's mostly like sitting on the other side of the fence of the presentation of psychotherapy in let's say professional settings, right? Not all the time, of course, and thank God I had wonderful teachers, which is also important to say, in New York and otherwise, and very good colleagues,
right,
with whom I feel I shared. A lot, but as a rule, like I'm sitting there and frequently I don't feel it. And my sense is that many beginning therapists feel that way. Maybe they want to admit it to themselves, or the field doesn't allow for this kind of like it's not professional to admit it, that you're actually not sure what you're doing. You immediately need to kind of dress it in some psychoanalytic sauce or whatever, but I feel like no, that's just what it is. I forgot the second thing,
let me ask you about, because it brought up a question for me that is probably more general. Maybe you could describe your training for us, because it seems so. Eclectic in a sense, and I get a feeling you don't like that word, but
more and more, I have to say.
Okay. all the different approaches and techniques you kind of get familiarized with. Like, what was all that part of your training?
Yeah, well, I was very fortunate in my training, actually, and I think my training is a representative of quote unquote modern psychotherapeutic training. So my undergrad is from Israel, and I did some para psychotherapeutic stuff in Israel. I worked with juvenile delinquents for 2 years in Jerusalem. And,
oh wow!
It wasn't exactly therapy; it was just. Trying to reach those people in Jerusalem, going in the car to their homes and things of that nature. But in my graduate school, my training was quite diverse, I think. First of all, in my program, we had introduction to, you know, the big therapists like CBT, DBT, IPT. IPT is also connected to where I trained. Intimately and I think it's just the case for most of us, and I think it's good actually, right, that we're exposed to to many modalities, there's a benefit there. I remember I was very fortunate to sit on a seminar with Karen Berg,
right,
at Columbia Psychoanalytic, and we were there like, I don't know, 6-7 people. I was an extern, I think, at the time at Columbia Psychoanalytic, and there were mostly more seasoned people. And I remember Karen Berg has this thing. I don't know if you've ever seen him in live, but
mm-hmm.
he reads.
I have, yeah,
you have. Yeah. So he reads from this like yellow pages.
Yeah.
Yeah. You saw it, and it's so organized. Like it's one mm-hmm. leads to two, leads to three, leads to mm-hmm. four, which is again incredible. And his contribution to the field, I mean, I don't need to say. But I remember going out of there with a colleague who was actually a psychiatrist training to be a psychoanalyst, and we were both talking that it's just not like that for us anymore, right?
We
don't look at it only from a psychoanalytic lens anymore. We can't. I mean, at that particular setting, you know, there were people who were neuroscientists, and there was a psychologist who was a cognitive expert and did some really cool research. And there were some behavioral people, and that's, I think, the world of psychotherapy. And
eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
To my mind, currently, I think it's a good thing because I think you can reach people through different avenues. You know, you mentioned that I'm working at Headspace Jerusalem now, and it's true, and it's a short-term kind of treatment. And we always talk with other therapists that just like, let's reach the person in front of us. However we do that, I don't care.
Right.
I write it in the book, my model, quote unquote, that kind of has developed over the years is whatever works. That's what I'll do. If it mm-hmm. means behavioral exposure with someone and just like going on the streets or driving with them, I do that stuff in my private practice nowadays. Mm-hmm. And I encourage the therapists that I work with at Headspace to do that. And if it means like a poignant, hopefully dynamic interpretation about something that actually is in the transference, that why not? And by the way, why not both, right?
Like, right.
If that's something I also never understood and never accepted, this differentiation, right? The camps, right? There is this camp, there is this camp, and there is this camp. And I disagree. I think you can think of a person from many different perspectives. And we're very lucky to have neuroscience. We're very lucky to have cognitive research, and we're very lucky to have psychoanalysis. And
let me push you a bit on this point, because there's in the book, right, you were describing in the first chapter, you talking to your own therapist, your training therapist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like just presenting the same ideas to him, and he's asking a question that I'm asking now as well. But what do you propose then? Not having like a set of core beliefs about people, and just being like eclectic? Is that the alternative?
Well, you know, it's a very good question. I think that he asked me, and I ask myself frequently. I remember when I was in New York, a friend of mine and I, a friend by the name of Jane Kaflisch, who's a star in New York and a wonderful therapist, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she and I organized a conference for graduate school graduate students that was called Choice and Abundance.
Right.
Choosing a therapy in a world of too many psychotherapies. And we were curious, both of us, Jane and I, how to do it, right? And I remember one of the speakers there was Eric Marcus, who at the time was the director of the Columbia Psychological. I don't think he's anymore, but it doesn't matter. And he came in and he said what he does, doesn't necessarily come with a set theory that he wants to present to the patient. His theory of mind is the patient's theory of mind. That's where he connects to the patient. It really changed my perspective. So my perspective is not what's in general true in the world. Let's say relational psychoanalysis is true in the world. But let's see the person in front of us. Let's say it's a 20-year-old graduate student who's neurotic and, I don't know, 20-year-old, not graduate student, but whatever, a college student, and who's very verbal and into literature, and whether she pulls for something probably dynamic. And then we can think maybe it's a relational thing or maybe it's more classic, depends. But whatever the problem is, I feel. But what about if it's a really concrete person who just, I don't know, has OCD? Like, okay, let's try to solve that for a moment. So I think you have to be flexible. And the danger is losing a core. I think it is a danger.
Yeah.
And I think there is a certain envy of people who are settled in their theory. But I don't feel it's true enough. You know, and I was so happy to read Jung recently that says, you know, if I can quote like just two sentences from him. This is Jung. I am often asked about my psychotherapeutic or analytic method. I cannot reply unequivocally to the question. Therapy is different in every case. When a doctor tells me that he adheres strictly to this or that method, I have my doubts about his therapeutic effect. So that's been...
Right. I see, I get that. But then I think what you do with a patient, what you say, how you act is one thing. But how you theorize for yourself, what is happening between the two of you is something like, I guess, a little more detached and something different altogether. And I think you can do all these interventions, like you're saying, like being a lot more active than classical psychoanalysts, but still have a psychoanalytic frame and think psychoanalytically what is going on. And I think that is actually something you're doing from my perspective, right?
Yes, I just absolutely, or at least absolutely I'm trying, but it's like asking who's, what's true, Dostoevsky or Tolstoy, right? Who got it? Depends what. Depends what situation we're describing. Some situations, some human situations were best described by Dostoevsky, maybe in the history of literature. Right. And some human situations were best described by Tolstoy. And when I'm seeing that situation in front of me, I would think this or that. Similarly, I think to psychoanalysis, right? Sometimes you meet someone and you just immediately think, like, I don't know, let's say object relations. Or you do use the word transference if needed to be, or you do think of someone who has a split view of the world, negative, positive, and you do start thinking about Kernberg. But I don't see a way to have one view and also to have one view that is only psychoanalytical. Right, because neuroscience? What about just affect research? What about life in general? Right, like sometimes this is one of my biggest problems with psychotherapy. It's so removed from life, right? It's so removed from the discussion about like, wait, before we say all those terms, but just like, where is he in life? He just moved to another country, let's say. He doesn't find his path, sounds too much like me, but I mean, like, whatever, let's take another example, but I mean, like, just like a she, right? She just went on 7 dates and not sure whether to go on another date with someone. Is it really psychoanalytic, or is it just life and modern norms of dating that she's experiencing, for example, right? And that's what's really going on. Or she has a certain view of life that doesn't correspond to what's happening in front of her.
I was also just thinking about the book again and about the patients you meet, right? Because there's a lot of work that you do in community clinics. And for people who have like severely in the thralls of poverty, of racial prejudice, just like these intense political problems, right? Like within just, I don't know, late capitalism, the neoliberal setting of politics, right? And then you come along as a psychotherapist with your techniques trying to fix problems that probably have like a very political perspective to them as well, right?
Absolutely. I feel that God devised the world in such a way that mental health is a great equalizer between people.
Right.
And I think it's written in the book as well. You know, I did meet someone from the Upper East Side growing in what we would call privileged, not racially discriminated against, and just like someone from, and not only her, of course, and I'm seeing it every day in my clinic, people who are supposedly privileged have the best life from the outside, but doesn't feel that way. And on the other hand, sometimes, thankfully, people who are completely underprivileged and poor and so on have resilience and
right.
So I feel it would be for me. How would I say? Like almost too simple to say that this is definitely in the background sometimes, and of course, when you add just poverty to the equation,
right?
It adds something, or discrimination, of course. But I think many times I felt that on the contrary, like many privileged people, quote unquote or not quote unquote, are the most suffering people I met.
Right.
And during my career, maybe less so in the book, because the book is centered on community clinics, and the training typically is done in community clinics and hospitals, which serve the public. Sometimes I also feel that cultural kind of difference, at least in New York, is a strength, right? When someone is black or Latino or even, well, I wouldn't say poor, but kind of that outsider from the norm is sometimes, I feel, a great source of strength. Cultural strength, traditions that were in home, that are kind of maybe preserved, even if the mainstream doesn't accept them, and so on. So I don't know. Although, of course, you know, the world always can be better. But I'm not sure if America now is prosperous, and even if in the prosperous parts of America, let's say in the white prosperous parts of America, it doesn't feel that the mental health is great, even among. I'm sorry, our colleagues, right? I mean, you go to a psycholytic conference or psychotherapeutic conference, we're all super privileged to have good jobs. We're relatively, I wouldn't say wealthy, of course, but we're doing fine financially. And frequently you look at that and it's just a neurotic room, right? And so when I hear that them talking about the other, right, that is not privileged as themselves, which I think is a great, kind of sensibility that the therapists have, and they should cherish it. But I also should look just in the room and see what's up. And what's up is frequently just a level of neuroticism that is not there, for example, in a boxing gym where I trained for a year in New York with very underprivileged people. And I know it's a romantic view and too romantic. And I know it's not perhaps not a very popular view. But I feel it's the truth, and I feel that therapy, again, as I said, not even therapy, mental health is a great equalizer. Like
let me just mm-hmm. interrupt you there real quick, because mm-hmm. I think what's up is also just in a way, without getting too shallow in the argument here, but the culture of narcissism, right? And you described this in the case with this woman from a very privileged background that you were talking about in the book, the culture of am I blank enough, like beautiful enough, rich enough, successful enough. And I think the book is very interesting in the instances where you described that on the side of the patient, but also on your own side, right? And that's, I think, something that many, many people in the field can relate to.
What do you mean exactly? You mean
the not like the feeling of not being enough in any of those instances, right? Not being accomplished enough, not being smart enough, not being whatever, right? Like, I mean, you name
it. Yeah, absolutely. I think that this is kind of it's just being human. And I think the more elite you go, the more you encounter, in my experience, people with those kind of questions about themselves and with those problems. And I definitely, like any other human being, struggle with letting go as much as I can. Of the narcissistic drive and you know, the prestige drive, the, for example, how many copies the book will sell, because answer is not, well, who knows, right? Probably maybe not too many. Maybe many, I don't know. Like, but let's not put my self-value completely on this, because I think however many copies it sells, I might get disappointed. I have a hunch that this might not be the answer to my well-being. I'm not quite sure, but you tell me.
But
I have a sense that maybe not enough.
Let me ask one more question. That's more like in general, and then maybe we can get to you reading a passage of the book.
Oh, I would love that. Thank you.
Yes. I really want listeners to get a sense of your voice, right? But one more question. That was really interesting to me, especially in relation to the group therapy session, because it's male group therapy, right? And leading up to the sessions or the process you describe, are what felt to me like a meditation on being a man, being male in a profession that's at this point and in very many places in the world so female dominated. And I was wondering if you could speak on that.
Thank you. It's a really good question, because I think it's definitely been part of my own process of coming to terms with being a man and a psychotherapist. It's where I come from, it's absolutely not clear that this is what men should do, being therapists. It's kind of strange. And I think in that chapter, Good Morning Man, I think it was a mutual kind of contemplation of what does it mean perhaps to be a man. And I think it's confusing in 2019, I think, for many of us. I think it's less confusing to me now than it was when I started, let's say, my psychological journey. I think I'm just okay with that, honestly, now, being a man and a therapist. But it took time. It took time to understand that it's okay to do that. And maybe it even suits my personality. I don't know.
But I thought it was very interesting in the book. It's dedicated to your mother.
Yes, it's just one.
And in the acknowledgments, you thank four women.
Yes. And so the book is dedicated to my mother, who's a very sensitive and wonderful psychiatrist, by the way.
Oh, wow. That's very interesting.
Yes, she is. And a very unusual psychiatrist, I feel, in the best way. And so she did a lot of good work in the world, and thankfully continues to do that.
And that's awesome.
And was very supportive of this project, kind of pushed me all the way, always, with all my doubts, and is it good enough? Does anyone need this? She's really been kind of the number one fan, and I felt
that's awesome. So you had a really facilitating environment there.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And without her, I don't think this book would have been written. It's not just like a nice thing to say. I'm actually not sure I would have written it without her support. Right. It so happened that, I was supported by four women. One of them is my agent. Another is my editor. It's Sphinx. And two others helped me edit it to people that I knew who were wonderful, all of them. A male female joint venture, which is the best.
As it should be.
As it should be. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, because I actually think like we're probably best in our practice when we have those female and male parts in ourselves integrated, right? So
absolutely. I think that's on us to try to do that, and it's on me to try to connect the two, the anima and the animus inside of me and in all of us. I think it's real. I think we do have female and male parts, and I think they're a holistic kind of combination. And I think every person has to find the balance for himself or herself. But definitely I've been trying to do that, and I feel, again, okay with it now. Let's see what happens right. In the future. But now it feels like we have other problems. This is not the problem.
That's good. Great. Great. So, Barry, would it be okay for you to read a passage from the book? You were saying you wanted to start like quite early on in the journey, so to say, like one of the first patients you're presenting in the book.
Yes.
And just read a few pages from the treatment there.
Yes, thank you so much, Sebastian. So this is from the second chapter, which is essentially the first chapter after my own therapy. And quite early on, this is an amazing woman that I met, who was quite different from her appearance. Her appearance was very scary to people and to myself in the beginning, and very distancing. She looked nothing like me, right? And it turned out to be one of the best things, I think, in meeting her. But also, I think the chapter is about that discrepancy about the field, the way therapy is presented, and how it feels doing it. So I wanted to read one short passage that I think kind of summarizes maybe or the main idea of the book, perhaps. So
great,
thank you so much. So we're beginning here. This is me saying something to the supervisor, and then we'll take it from her. The woman is named in the book Miss Johnson, and this is quite early, as you said, in my training, and also quite early in the book itself. So it goes like this. I feel that you got really attached to her, which might be a good thing or a slightly dangerous thing, Valerie, and I invite you to reflect on that. What is it in the transference that created that? Why do you think it happened? A supervisor asked me. It happened because she's a poet, I replied. Because the unbelievable harshness of her life never killed her elegance. Because the horrible abuse that had threatened to extinguish her humanity achieved the opposite. It strengthened it. Harold Searles, a psychiatrist who worked with severely ill, typically psychotic patients in the 50s, wrote that what is healing in psychotherapy with such patients is seeing more in a person that she can see herself. Maybe, ultimately, that was my treatment approach at Miss Johnson. Maybe by sensing that there was so much more to her than the cliched image of, quote, poor, homeless, and traumatized, I allowed her to believe, for a moment, that she was in fact more than that image, that the abusers never fulfilled their sick wishes. So more than anything else, and instead of the classic interventions, most of which seemed inappropriate and, frankly, weird sometimes, we went for the, quote, celebrate the poet inside you and the abusers can go fuck themselves approach, not supported by empirical research yet. It sounds humanistic and hopeful. The reality was much darker. In spite of everything that had happened between us in the room, she still came back home and had two or three panic attacks a day, slept no more than a couple of hours at night, did not have the strength and resources to get rid of her abusive boyfriend, was afraid to go out of her house, and took a tremendous amount of psychiatric medication to calm down, to feel, quote, sane. So the seeing did not exactly translate to living, which led to some uncomfortable questions about my chosen profession. How can any therapist, I wonder, be it a psychodynamic or a CBT one, not feel the profound limitation of psychotherapy as a tool for change, as a curative process, when observing the tragic unfolding of Ms. Johnson's life? Not wake up in cold sweat, dreading the inevitable conclusion that psychotherapy doesn't actually achieve much. She couldn't ride the bus after months of psychotherapy. It's nice to talk, to listen, to provide, quote, safe spaces, but it's not so nice to see someone's life steamrolling towards the abyss while you stand there gently nodding and providing empathic statements or worksheets or skills, even empirically validated ones for trauma treatment, but actually, in truth, doing very little to stop it. How smug and deluded would I have to believe that the few moments of poetic reprieve which I was maybe able to give to her were actually a great success or a sign of significant change. Watching her, after several weeks and then even months, crawling into our clinic, frightened, sweaty, defeated by life, afraid of everyone and everything, how could I not think that I was actually not helping her very much? What sort of a sophisticated Greek or Latin term? What citation by a famous psychoanalyst? What indication of a measure on which she had better results could quash that anxiety? Why would I believe, if I saw her crawling on her knees, not believing in anything, not hoping for anything, that, no, don't worry, Valerie, you're doing a great job. These feelings were not aroused in me only by people who experienced the unthinkable tragedies that Ms. Johnson had experienced. In my first few years of training, every patient made me feel like that, to a certain degree. The changes, if they happened at all, were barely visible. A better conversation with someone's mother, after 9 months. A calmer reaction to the boss, feeling a little more self-confident, approaching a boy at a party, things like that. Fighting for the smallest of changes with my struggling patients, I began to resent the glib, out-of-touch depiction of psychotherapy, the prevalent tone of our empirical and theoretical literature. Everything is so annoyingly neat and tidy. Intervention A leads to result B. In the meanwhile, in the treatment rooms, hordes of therapists, perhaps especially beginners who are more attuned to the truth and not to the theoretical ideas about the truth, feel like idiots, stuck in the quagmire of life with their patients, not able to get out of it, despite what the great authors suggest would happen if you just use the right intervention. Psychotherapy, in my experience, feels nothing like a paper about psychotherapy. What I realized over the years of my training was that change had to be formulated differently. I had to come to terms with a certain something, maybe small, maybe a little more than that, that I felt I was able to give to the people I worked with, but nothing like the typical depictions, the unbelievable transformations. What is the meaning of life? Asks Lily Briscoe in Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse. She proceeds to answer. The great revelation had never come. Instead, there were little daily miracles, illuminations, matches struck unexpectedly in the dark. Here was one. In the messiness of psychotherapy, the achievements are fleeting, amorphous, barely felt. Without accepting this, I believe, we cannot really affect the people we work with, cannot escape the traps of fancy-sounding jargon that hides our fear of doing nothing.
Wow, thank you so much for reading that. I think it really sums up a lot of what we talked about, what the book is about. And what just came to my mind after or while you were reading is the core of what you're describing with many of the patients you talk about in the book of your shared work is the relationship, right?
Yes.
And I mean, the ability to stay in a relationship with people whose connections to others have sometimes dramatically unraveled.
Yeah.
And they have they do a lot to keep it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you capture beautifully is your way and your struggle and your persistence in staying in a relationship with these people. And it's amazing.
Thank you. Because we are, because I'm talking to you from Jerusalem, so let me maybe finish from Ecclesiastes. And it's been my motto in psychotherapy in general. It's a bit of a simple translation, but still, let's roll with it. And it, kind of came about when you were saying this, but whatever you find to do with your hands, do it with all your might. For in Sheol, where you are going, there is no work or planning or knowledge or wisdom. So we have a limited time here.
Yeah, we do.
In that limited time, I hope to do something for the people I meet. And I hope that till the last days of my being a clinical psychologist and a therapist, I will not stop trying to do something.
That's great. Thank you so much. Thank you. Before we end here, let me just ask, do you have anything else about to be published? What are you working on at the moment?
So, no, I'm waiting. Like this book was published just recently, 2 months ago or so. And I'm waiting to see whether the world needs it.
I'm sure it will. And people will be thrilled to read such an honest account of psychotherapy.
And I feel like, you know, I'm writing here and there, like small things, but I feel like the next project has to come after I live a life, meaning that I have to feel completely differently about psychotherapy. Yeah. I don't have anything to add at the moment on this book. I can write more stories, but I think they're going to say very similar things. I think I have to live a life. I think I have to enter another stage of my life. I don't have my own family yet.
Right.
Hopefully that will happen, and many other things. And when all of that happens, maybe I'll feel something else about therapy, and maybe I will be, I don't know, motivated to share it. This project took me 5 years, so
right.
Maybe I'll decide to do it again.
Great. Valerie, I wish you all the best with all the endeavors you were just talking about. And I just wanted to add for the listening audience, it might be worthwhile to check out our interviews with Sandra Büchler,
yes,
who's actually commented on a paper of Valerie's. And I think she speaks to a lot of issues that you are raising,
yes,
about the profession, about the field.
Yes.
So our listeners might really be interested in hearing those interviews as well.
Absolutely. And she's definitely one of the wonderful teachers I said that you know, kind of I met in New York. She's a very wise, smart psychoanalyst, and I was fortunate to meet her in many different venues and to learn from her. So it was, you know, kind of great thing to see that this is published after her. Our podcast, our conversation published after her. It's
right.
Kind of a wonderful coincidence, or probably it's not a coincidence.
That's great. So yeah. Give those a try. Check out those other interviews. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you very much, Valerie, for talking to me and for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. I really appreciate your kind words and this wonderful conversation. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, and bye-bye.